Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Philip Levine, whose most recent book, Breath, published by Knopf, has recently appeared in paperback. Now, I want to celebrate Philip Levine because the fact of the matter is, as people who've been listening to the show for some time know, poetry did not come naturally to me. In fact, it bewildered me for a very long time. And, you know, I went to a college that was swarming with poets. Readings were constant. It was the middle of the so-called revolution. And so, you know, the popularity of poetry was at a height. But it wasn't until I heard certain poems, among them Philip Levine's They Feed, They Lion, that I started to get thrilled by it. And I want to always recognize that, you know, for a lot of people, everyone thinks that if you say you like poetry, that you must be pretending or something, like saying you like opera. But you know, refinement doesn't come easily to certain kinds of people. It didn't to me. And this poem, They Feed Their Lion, it was the title poem from the book, They Feed Their Lion, was the poem really that ignited me.
Would you like me to read it?
I would love you to read it.
Okay. Let's see, I wrote this poem back in about 1967. So it's got some years on it. It's a little long in the tooth, but I think it's hard to read, but I'll do my best. They feed their lion. Out of burlap sacks, out of bearing butter, out of black bean and wet slate bread, out of the acids of rage, the candor of tar, out of creosote, gasoline, drive shafts, wooden dollies, they lie and grow. Out of the gray hills of industrial barns, out of rain, out of bus ride, West Virginia to kiss my ass, out of buried aunties, mothers hardening like pounded stumps, out of stumps, out of the bones need to sharpen and the muscles to stretch, they lie and grow. Earth is eating trees, fence posts, gutted cars. Earth is calling in her little ones. Come home, come home. From pig balls, from the ferocity of pig driven to holiness, from the furred ear and the full jowl, come the repose of the hung belly. From the purpose they lie and grow. From the sweet glues of the trotters, come the sweet kinks of the fist. From the full flower of the hams, the thorax of caves. From bow down, come rise up. Come they lion from the reeds of shovels, the grained arm that pulls the hands. They lion grow. From my five arms and all my hands, from all my white sins forgiven, they feed. From my car passing under the stars, they lion. From my children inherit. From the oak turned to a wall, they lion. From they sack and they belly opened, and all that was hidden burning on the oil-stained earth. They feed, they lion, and he comes.
Philip Levine reading a poem from one of his earlier books, I think the fourth, They Feed, They Lion. Now, Phil Levine has since written approximately 20 books of poetry, and the most recent one, as I mentioned, is Breath. But for me, that was the beginning. I went backwards to Not This Pig, and what I supposed thrilled me the most was the kind of ferocity and anger that ran through it. And you talked about it once as being not so much an angry poem as a celebration of anger. And I wondered what that means.
Well, the poem grew out of what in Detroit, which is where I grew up, was called the Great Rebellion of 1967. It was at a time when the United States was fighting two racist wars, as I guess you'd have to say we are today. One was in Vietnam and one was in urban America. And at a certain point, of course, there were a great many black American soldiers dying in Vietnam, and the usual racism that I grew up with was being practiced. And the city revolted. And it went on for, I don't know, maybe 10 days. There'd been an event like this when I was a boy, but not as ferocious, in 1941. I wasn't living in Detroit when this happened. I went back to see the city, to talk to people I knew. There was now a broken bridge between the races. I don't know if it's healed or not. But moving around the city and meeting people I knew and going back to the neighborhoods that I'd lived in as a kid, or not as a kid, as a young man when I was working, I encountered a lot of this raw, extraordinary energy and a certain amount of pride in a people that were saying, enough, enough. You've done enough to us. We can't take it anymore. The weight is too great. And also, there was an ambiguity in my own heart, a crazy sense of who I was. I was a teacher at Fresno State. I was white. I was entering the middle class. My salary still stunk from Fresno State. I was an assistant professor. But I wasn't one of the industrial workers. I wasn't somebody suffering under the thumb of General Motors anymore. So I also saw myself as a portion of the enemy. And I think it was out of that multiplicity of emotions that the tension in the poem arose from.
Now, sometimes in the newer books, there are poems that are about the terrible comedy of American complacency. And there's a poem in the new book, Breath, called Home for the Holidays, which I sense is about another world in which the objects have become more expressive than the people. Another, in a sense, poem of objects, of things in a kind of rebellion. And I thought, by contrast, I would ask you to read Home for the Holidays from Breath by my guest Philip Levine.
In some ways, you're right. It is similar in that also it's very lyric. I mean, it attempts at least to be very lyrical poem, to kind of sing the way They Feed Their Lions sings. And yet it's situated, as you say, in middle-class America. Home for the Holidays. Does anyone give a crap? Not I, said the little brown mouse. And so to bed, said mother. But no one was listening. Praise the Lord, said the radio. The radio said, praise the Lord again, and the television turned its back on the room. Turnips for wisdom. Eggplant for beauty, parsnips for ease, cabbage for size, a raw egg for the hair. A slice of ham to seize the hips, for the nose, foxglove and salt, for grace, ice-cold water poured from way high up to way down low. Everyone sits at the big table in the dark. The empty plates moon, the silverware stars, the napkins scrub their hands. I'm home, says the front door. The windows are deep in thought. The roof has taken off its hat. Nothing to do, chants the toilet. I think this poem also grew out of my agony as a young man and a kid, especially as a kid, over the holidays. My mother worked full time. My father died when I was a child. My mother had to work full time. She had three sons. She did her best, but kids don't know she's doing the best, right? And so she hoped for a kind of Saturday Evening Post Thanksgiving, you know? and she couldn't cook worth a damn. So we'd sit at these terrible dinners, and it was a comedy, you know. It was a comedy. And, of course, any dinner with a family, my grandfather and my grandmother would be there. They were immigrants, as was my mother. And arguments would start, and, you know, all the crap from that year would start floating up to the surface, and, or my aunt was there, and she didn't get along with my mother, and, I mean, and her husband was an idiot. I mean, it was coming home for the holidays was a nightmare. You know?
Everyone talks about, after they feed the lion, the dealing with the past in 1933, the early death of your father, and the growing tenderness and acceptance of the poems. But it also, the career, traces a growing almost resignation, tender resignation maybe, in American poetry for the loss of an excitement and revolutionary attitude that seemed to be possible in America in the late 60s and early 70s. And I wondered whether it's difficult to sustain the ferocity as a country figures out the tricks by which passions are diffused.
Well, you know, you have your options. You know, you can murder those who are murdering you, and that's a crime to murder. On the other hand, sometimes it seems worth it. As you get older and your children, and you have children, you have a family, there's a way in which you're weighted down. Those romantic gestures become just that, romantic gestures. The society that wouldn't understand them at all anyway. You could say everything you want and nothing would come of it except that you were a criminal or that you were insane. I had hopes, as you know, and many of us did, of a radical movement in America that would be radically powerful and popular. It didn't happen. We got the Weather Underground. We got a number of groups that were labeled as crazy. For many years, I was an anarchist. I mean, I really supported the tenets of anarchism. Property was theft. Revolution by the deed, which is now called terrorism. But at a certain point, I guess it grew very much out of the faith, out of an almost religious faith in the beauty of the human. And out of that faith in the beauty of the human came this great rage against seeing the human crushed and distorted by the industrial society and the consumer society of the United States, or the whole Western world for that matter. And then, you know, as the years went on, I began to lose that faith. It began to ebb. There wasn't much in the society to sustain it, and I couldn't find comrades, you could say. I couldn't find comrades. Or when I did find them, all I wanted to do was argue. You know, a room full of anarchists is a nightmare.
I'm speaking with Philip Levine, author most recently of Breath, which has come out in paperback from Knopf. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and of course you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Philip Levine about his new book of poems, Breath. What I noticed is that, certainly in its fourth section, the soul-making travels across the world from country to country in the form of misery. The first poem is a poem about the millennium, and the anticipation is not of world peace or world happiness. It's a day-long spread as the sun strikes each new place of a certain revelation of the miseries thereof. And in a poem like Yankel, the character is traveling from culture to culture, trailing the sorrows he comes with and allowing to follow after him the physical goods that he acquires. And I thought I'd ask you to read Yankel.
Yankel, sure. It's not just a celebration of misery, though. It's also a celebration of the capacity of the human to overcome this misery, to endure it, and in some ways, in enduring it, almost to triumph over it. Yankel. He blessed each weed budding in the spring fields. To him the mornings were music, with the rain glistening softly on the scattered stones. All the long spring days, while the sparrowhawks circle slowly over the weed patches. My great uncle Yankel had done his time. 30 years in Siberia, felling giant birch trees summer and winter. After one crushed his leg, he made his way by night to Incheon and the Americans, who sent him on to me, 1955, the oldest stock boy in Christendom, working nights at Safeway to pay for his own washing machine and dryer. His plan was simple: to join his family in Israel. One evening after dinner, 2 weeks before he left, he asked to pray with me, to give thanks. He in Russian, I in English. Not in Hebrew, I asked. Only the righteous could pray in Hebrew. God might hear and punish both of us. Who was there for him to thank, and for what? The years in prison, the gift of a maimed leg on which he'd take his morning walk, listing back and forth, no matter what the weather. So we prayed, side by side before the blank TV, bowing and rising while my kids stared. The appliances floated on ahead by ship to Haifa to find his sons grown to manhood. Today, I'd walk the fields in the winter chill, if the fields were still here, and not the dull miles of suburban houses. May the rain fall on the little graveyard where he now lies, in an unmarked grave in the Judean hills. May it pool on the hard yellow clay, so unheard music can rise and descend. May the earth hear and rejoice in his gifts, the bounty of one who took what was given. May it bless him in the language of the wind.
Philip Levine reading Yankel from his most recent book, Breath. Now, I've been attempting to find the words for the ruefulness of the tone, because it sometimes used to be called misanthropic comedy. And Nathaniel West had a certain famous gift for it, but this isn't misanthropic. Do you have a way of describing that kind of mixture of ferocious comedy and sweetness?
I don't have a word for it. I don't know what I have for it, to be honest. I know it's there. I know what you're driving at, and I think it's a quality that you wouldn't find in my poetry, say, up till, One for the Rose. I'm proofreading a selected poems, a different book from the one Knapp brought out that's going to be published in England. And in going through it, I was struck by because I don't tend to reread my own poems. I was struck by this sudden or by the beginning of this attitude that you're talking about, that began probably when I was around 50. And as my faith in anarchism drifted off, something replaced it, a kind of chuckle in the face of death, of everything that America was pouring on and the world and life was pouring on to those who deserved better and who really earned better day by day but didn't get their earnings, you know. Something replaced it, and I think you described it. I can't describe it any better. I don't know that there is a description for it. I'll let someone else come. It's a feeling in me that I find very sustaining.
Well, the other thing that goes along with it that I kind of love, there was a period there where I found in your poetry the stresses of the lines and the sustained propulsion of the syntax was dragging the poem along even after the poem itself had lost faith in its power. The poem knew that the noise it was making was powerful, but the ideas it was expressing were no longer powerful. And that got replaced in a way by this new comic vulnerability that's still tough but isn't going to pretend that a poem can carry on its shoulders the weights of the world. And so the poems have become, in a way, poems of glorious surrender by people who are not cowards, you know?
People who in many cases have no idea they're surrendering. They think they're still battling their well, they are, in fact, battling their battles. But I, as a third-person observer, say, I see that of course, it's useless. But the habit of resistance is bred into these people. I suppose it comes from my own experience from meeting these people when I was a kid in Detroit and working with them. You know, there was such a huge influx from the South of people with both black and white with a powerful morality, biblically based in many cases. Really, it seemed Old Testament based, and a sweetness and a generosity. If you stayed away from race, they were the most fabulous people I've ever known, and they didn't take crap from anybody, and they were like models of what people ought to be to me. They were simple. When I came across Whitman's advice to the American poet to, you know, go among powerful, uneducated people, I realized I'd done it without ever intending to do it.
When you started out, there were poems of famous anger, some of the Lowell poetry,
yeah,
you know, Plath poetry, a poetry where the mixture of the discoveries about short lines and the stress and speed of the short line mixed with the sustained syntax to create a poem of agonized rage. These poems, they seem to have influenced you hugely, but over the years, you've passed through them to a poem of kind of gorgeous acceptance. It's not peaceful. The resentments and the bitternesses are still alive, but the poem knows better than to have a tantrum. And there's something so beautiful to me about that. You sense that the poem could have a tantrum if it wanted to, but it's learned better than to enact futile emotionalism.
Well, the poems know better than I do. I mean, I think whenever we write a really good poem, it knows more than we do. To judge our personalities by our poems is a mistake. We can still be petty and jerks and jealous and, you know, of ridden with the urge for acceptance and fame and what have you. But the poems themselves, they have their own personalities, and we like the readers, have to learn from them. I mean, every time I write a really good poem, I know it's really good because I don't know where the hell it came from, you know?
Well, here, to conclude, is a poem that you'd never expect from the author of They Feed the Lion. It's the opening poem in Breath, and it's called Gospel.
Well, for one thing, the guy's moved to California. And he lives in Fresno, and not far away are the Sierra Nevadas, where the poem takes place. Gospel. The new grass rising in the hills, the cows loitering in the morning chill, a dozen or more old browns hidden in the shadow of the cottonwoods beside the stream bed. I go higher, to where the road gives up and there's only a faint path strewn with lupin between the mountain oaks. I don't ask myself what I'm looking for. I didn't come for answers to a place like this. I came to walk on the earth, still cold, still silent, still ungiving, I've said to myself, although it greets me with last year's dead thistles and this year's hard spines, early blooming wild onions, the curling remains of spider's cloth. What did I bring to the dance? In my back pocket, a crushed letter from a woman I've never met, bearing bad news I can do nothing about. So I wander these woods half sightless, while a west wind picks up in the trees clustered above. The pines make a music like no other, rising and falling like a distant surf at night that calms the darkness before first light. Suffing, we call it, from Old English no less. How weightless words are when nothing will do.
Philip Levine, reading Gospel from his most recent book of poetry, Breath, published by Knopf. And of course, I've been speaking with Phil Levine, and I want to thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
You can read a poem from Breath on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica, and you can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com and look for Bookworm under KCRW A to Z. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.